Thanks for tuning in to the Thirst for More podcast. I'm your host, Brandon Smitley. Thirst for More podcast was created to help strength and conditioning coaches, personal trainers, fitness enthusiasts, and anyone that loves lifting heavy shit all be connected under one roof. We take deep dives into coaching, programming and training, running gyms, nutrition, and overall improving your knowledge in the field of strength and conditioning. If you're new here, I'm glad you're able to tune in and hope you can just take away one awesome piece of information today to help you along with your journey. If you're a returning supporter, I appreciate you being along for the ride. Now let's dive into today's episode. Welcome back to the Thirst for More podcast, where we go beyond the surface to uncover what truly drives performance growth, fitness, and performance. I'm your host, Brandon Smitley, and today we're tackling a topic that gets massively oversimplified all the time, and that topic is speed development. Now, when most people think about getting faster, they have a pretty simple equation in their head. They usually just think, I just need to run more sprints. Maybe I'll add in some hill sprints, throw in some interval training, and boom, immediately you'll be a faster athlete. And look, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that's completely wrong. Running sprints will make you better at running sprints. But thinking that's all there is to speed development is like saying that the only way to get stronger is to just lift heavier things. Yes, it's a piece of the puzzle, but it's far from the complete picture or piece of that puzzle. So it's not even close to the complete picture in terms of improving your speed development. So here's what I want you to understand right from the start. Speed is not just a physical quality. It's not just about having strong legs or good conditioning. Speed is actually one of the most complex adaptations to the human body that it can develop. And think about what has happened for you to actually move fast. Your nervous system has to send signals from your brain down to your muscles at lightning speed. Your muscles have to actually produce massive amounts of force in fractions of a second. Your tendons have to store and release energy like springs. Your technique has to be dialed in so that you're not wasting even the smallest bit of energy. Your mind has to be in the right state, focused on not being too tense, aggressive but not tight. It's an orchestra of systems working in perfect harmony. And if even one of those sections is off, the whole performance begins to suffer. So today, we're going beyond just running fast. We're diving deep into the neuroscience behind speed, the biomechanics that separate fast athletes from the average ones, the power development strategies that create explosive movement, and even the mental components that make someone actually fast. Whether you're a competitive athlete trying to shave tenths of a second off your time, you're a weekend warrior who just wants to feel more explosive, or you're a coach looking to level up your training programs, this episode is going to change how you think about speed development. Because here's the reality that I really want to hammer home before I get into all the details, that you can run sprints until you're blue in the face, but if you don't understand the underlying mechanisms of speed, you're going to hit a plateau. You're going to hit a wall where more volume doesn't equal more speed. You're going to get frustrated wondering why you're working so hard, but not getting faster. And that's what this episode is actually about, giving you the complete roadmap so that you can train smarter, not just harder. So let's break it down. I'm going to go beyond the obvious piece of getting faster and really explore what it takes to develop elite level speed. So let's start where speed actually begins, and this might kind of surprise you because it's not going to be in your lower body. It's not even actually at the muscular level. Speed begins in your brain and with your nervous system. And understanding this is absolutely critical if you want to develop real speed, fastest athletes in the world. When we talk about speed, most people immediately focus on muscle size or lower body strength. And they look at a fast athlete and most people think, oh, they must have really strong legs. And yes, they do have strong legs, and strong legs do 100% matter to an extent. We'll get to that later. But here's what's fascinating and what most people actually miss. Your muscles can only contract as fast and as powerfully as your nervous system actually tells them to. Your muscles are just the machinery. Your nervous system is the operator. And if the operator isn't skilled, if the operator isn't fast, then it doesn't matter how good the machinery actually is. This concept is called neural drive, and it's the absolute foundation of everything we're going to talk about today in terms of speed. So let me explain how this works, because I think once you understand this, a lot of things about speed training are going to click into place for you. So inside your muscles, you have these things called motor units. You've probably heard about me talk about these and general strength training stuff on some of the podcasts and some of the YouTube videos that I have made in the past. A motor unit is basically a nerve in all the muscle fibers it controls. So when your brain wants to create movement, it sends down an electrical signal down the spinal cord out to these motor units. And now here's where things are really important. You have to different types of motor units. You have small, slow motor units that control type 1 muscle fibers. These are your more endurance-based fibers. They're great for lower intensity, long-duration activities. But for speed, we actually need to bring out the big guns. We need high threshold motor units that control type 2 muscle fibers, especially the type 2X fibers. These are your fast twitch explosive fibers. You probably hear about people being fast twitch and really twitchy. These are going to be the guys that you want. The problem is that your body doesn't recruit these high threshold motor units unless it absolutely has to. It's kind of like having a Ferrari in your garage, but only driving your Honda Civic because it saves gas. Your body is lazy and efficient. It only recruits the minimum amount of muscle needed to complete a task. So if you never train at high velocities, if you never demand maximum effort, your nervous system never learns to recruit these high threshold motor units quickly and efficiently. This is called rate coding and motor unit recruitment, and this is trainable. When you do proper speed work, when you sprint at maximum effort with full recovery, you're literally teaching your system to flip the switch to be faster. You're teaching your brain to recruit more motor units and to fire them more in sync, so to speak, is probably the best way to put it, meaning that at the same time, instead of in a staggered-based kind of pattern. The difference between trained and untrained nervous systems can be the difference between recruiting 70% of your available muscle fibers versus 95%. It's the exact same muscle being tapped into, but radically different performance. And you probably see this when you look at different strength levels and different performance levels, especially if people have similar body types. So think about it like this. Imagine your muscles are the engine of your car. Let's just, for example, say a V8 with quite a bit of horsepower. You've got 8 cylinders all ready to fire. But if your ignition system, your basically in this case, your nervous system can only fire 5 of those cylinders, or if it fires them 1 at a time instead of all at once, you're not going to get that power to the wheels and tap into the amount of power that you have. You're not going fast. Neural drive is your ignition system. It's what determines whether you're firing all 8 cylinders simultaneously with perfect timing or just sputtering along using half your potential. So now let's go a little bit deeper here to a deeper level of this, because there's another component to the neural side of speed, and that's the intermuscular coordination. This is a fancy way of saying that speed requires multiple muscle groups firing in perfect sequence with perfect timing. When you sprint, you're not just using your quads or your glutes just in isolation. You're using your hip flexors to drive your knee forward. You're using your glutes and your hamstrings to extend your hip, your calves to push into the ground, your core or your trunk musculature to stabilize your pelvis, your arms to drive your momentum. Every single one of these muscle groups has to fire exactly at the right time in the right sequence with the right amount of force to really optimize your maximum speed. Now, this is where we get into what's something called the stretch shortening cycle. You've probably heard of this before. It's your muscles and tendons working like springs. So when your foot hits the ground during a sprint, your muscles and tendons stretch, storing elastic energy. Then they immediately shorten, releasing that energy to propel you forward. This only works if timing is pretty much perfect. If you spend too much time on the ground, that elastic energy dissipates as heat. And if your muscles don't fire at the right moment, you can't capture that quote-unquote free energy. So elite sprinters have ground contact times of less than 0.1 second, less than a blink of an eye. That's not just strength, clearly, right? There is a physical adaptation happening at the tendinous level that is also what makes them super elite and super fast. That's neuromuscular coordination operating at an incredibly sophisticated level in terms of speed development. Here's the thing that's important to understand is that this coordination is trainable. It's not something you either have or you don't have. It is a skill. Yes, genetics will matter to some degree. If you have slower genetics compared to other people, then you can only tap out so much. But it is still a trainable skill, which means anybody can get faster and you can optimize and maximize your performance and your genetic potential as long as everything is all kind of lined out, which we'll get to throughout the rest of the episode. So your nervous system learns movement patterns through repetition at high qualities, right? You can't do poor quality performance-based work and expect to see high quality output. It doesn't work that way. But this is a massive but in this case. You can also train poor coordination if you're not careful with what you're doing. So if you practice sprinting when you're fatigued, for example, which we see a lot of sport coaches do, or if your form breaks down pretty consistently when you sprint, or you can't maintain high velocity while you're trying to train high velocity, you're actually teaching your nervous system to be slower and more efficient. You're grooving and basically ingraining slow movement patterns through your brain and through your neural systems. Now, this brings me to a concept that's going to be a theme throughout the whole episode that I have planned here, and that's the central nervous system fatigue. Your nervous system gets tired just like your muscles do, but it's a completely different type of fatigue. When your muscles are fatigued, they're metabolically depleted. When your when they've run out of fuel, then they've accumulated waste products. But when your nervous system is actually fatigued, it simply can't fire at high frequencies anymore. The signals get weaker and the coordination breaks down. The rate coding slows down. This is why speed training absolutely demands complete freshness, being completely optimized for every single rep and set and training day that you're doing. If you're trying to do speed work at the end of a hard workout or at the end of practice, after you've already done your strength training or your sport-specific skills, then you've already put yourself behind the eight ball in terms of training speed, because really you're not training speed anymore. You're training something, but it's not speed. Okay. It could be conditioning. It could be aerobic based work, but it's not going to be true speed development. You're training conditioning probably at the best, and at the worst, you're training your nervous system to be slow. So not ideal. Quality over quantity is not just a saying when it comes to speed work. It's actually probably a non-negotiable principle if you want to get faster. So right away, before we even talk about strength or power or technique, we can see that speed development requires healthy, fresh, well-trained nervous system. Your brain has to be able to send those powerful signals quickly to get the most out of your speed training. Your motor units have to be recruited efficiently. Your intermuscular coordination has to be pretty sharp. And all that requires training that respects the demand of your nervous system. You have to understand that your nervous system is a big piece of your speed and power development. So let me give you a practical takeaway here. If you're currently doing your sprint work or your explosive-based work at the end of your training sessions, you need to completely flip that around. You need to flip that on your head. You need to completely stop doing that, whether you're a sport coach, athlete, does not matter. Do not do sprint work at the end of any of your training, no matter what the reason is. Speed work should always come first. It always should be. There's a non-negotiable in that aspect. The research seems to support that. And working with the hundreds of athletes and thousands of hours that's been on athletes, the best athletes and the best training programs always have speed development at the forefront, especially at the beginning of the sessions or the beginning of the day, depending upon how that's all worked out. Because when your nervous system is fresh, you're mentally sharp, you haven't accumulated any kind of fatigue, that's when you want to train speed, and that's when you're going to see the best results from your speed training. You can do your strength work after. I think that's actually a great idea. And you can do your conditioning afterwards. Not a bad idea. I would ideally want to see it separated, but you can do it afterward, especially if you're crunched for time. But speed work demands the respect of freshness and high CNS output. And this one change in your training programs, if you're doing it the other way, just for your training sessions, can immediately give you likely more progress and you'll see better speed development. Really quick, before I move on to the next section, though, if you happen to be watching over on YouTube, do me a favor, hit that like button, subscribe, leave a comment, let me know you enjoyed the episode. And if you're listening over on Spotify, Apple, iTunes, anywhere you enjoy your podcast, do me a favor, hop on over and leave a 5-star review and let me know that you're enjoying the podcast. All right, back to the next section, though. Now that we understand the neural foundation, let's kind of talk about the physical side of speed, because I think this is still important, right? I'm not going to downplay the physical portion of speed. And this is where we get to one of my favorite topics, because it's where the physics starts to meet the biology. And we're going to talk about the relationship between force production and velocity. And understanding this is going to revolutionize how you actually think about speed training. So there's a concept here in exercise science called the force velocity curve. And if you take nothing else away from this episode, I want you to understand this force velocity curve and this relationship, because it explains so much about why certain training methods work and why others don't. So here's how the force velocity curve works in a simple explanation. First of all, I would encourage you, if you're on a computer or you're on a cell phone, we get the chime, look up force velocity curve on Google Images. That will give you a nice visual representation here. So if you're not, and you happen to be listening audibly and you don't know what the force velocity curve, I'm going to explain it for you here. So just imagine a graph. And on one end of the graph, you're going to have maximum force production. This is like your powerlifter squatting 600 pounds. It's slow, it's grinding, but the force being produced is pretty big. On the other hand of the graph, you're going to have the maximum velocity. And this is like, you know, snapping your finger or swinging a ping pong paddle or a tennis racket, something really light. It's incredibly fast, but there's very little resistance. Very little force is actually being produced. These two qualities exist on opposite ends of the spectrum. So here's where it gets interesting, though. That right in the middle of this curve, you have this sweet spot. And you have what most people will call as on that curve is going to be your power. And power is the optimal blend of force and speed. So power happens when you can produce high amounts of force and move quickly at the same time. And here's the key thing that's going to change everything from your training perspective if you understand this curve. That speed isn't just about moving fast. Speed is about producing high amounts of force in the least amount of time. And if you can only move fast against no resistance, then you're not going to be a fast athlete. You could still be a fast athlete, but you're not going to be the fastest athlete you can be. You need to be able to overcome the resistance quickly. And for many sports, that's going to be gravity to some degree, or being able to get moving forward. So let me give you a practical example here. So a powerlifter example, going back to our powerlifting portion on this curve, might be able to squat 600 pounds, but they do it pretty damn slow. Right, 600 pounds isn't going to move fast for a whole lot of people. It might take them 3 or 4 seconds to be able to complete a true max effort rep. On the other end, you're going to have like a speed skater that might move their legs incredibly quickly, and they're doing it against relatively little resistance, just a little bit on the ice. There's going to be some friction, but pretty minimal. And the fastest athletes, the people who win gold medals in sprinting in the Olympics in the 100 meters, who obviously move incredibly fast, or you could be looking at like a wide receiver or a running back running past somebody in football. They blow by their competition and they can produce massive amounts of force and they can move quickly while doing it. That is the definition of power. That's the middle or sweet spot of your force velocity curve. So now let's also talk about a concept that's critical for the speed development, and that's going to be the rate of force development, also known as RFD. You'll hear about this a lot in Louis Simmons' West Side Barbell work, but rate of force development is also incredibly important when it comes to being fast, and many people ignore this aspect of being fast. And it might be arguably the single most important concept for actually understanding speed, because rate of force development is exactly what it sounds like. It's not about how much force you can produce at maximum, it's about how fast you can produce that force. And the reason this matters for sprinting is because when you're running at maximum velocity, your foot is on the ground for, you know, less than 0.1 second if you happen to be pretty quick. And that's 1/10 of a second. That's a very small window of time that you need to be able to produce force to propel your body forward in space. So you don't have time to gradually build that force up, because if you do, you're going to be slow. So you need to produce it like that. That is basically force development, how quickly you can get going. So the difference between pushing a heavy sled across like the floor or the turf versus clapping your hands, when you push that heavy sled, you can take your time, and you're going to have to take your time. You can gradually apply more force until it starts moving. But when you actually go to like clap your hands, you're producing force explosively and immediately like that, right? It's very quick. Sprinting is more like the clapping than it is actually trying to push a heavy object and build that force up to get it to budge. So you need explosive, very quick force production, not gradual force, to be able to run as fast as possible. And this is why I can't stress this enough, is this is why just getting stronger in the traditional sense doesn't automatically make you faster. I see this constantly in our field or with sport coaches. An athlete or a coach might say, I need to get stronger, the athlete or the coach might say, I need to get faster, so I'm going to focus on squats and deadlifts. I'm going to build up my maximum strength. And I understand building a foundation of strength is important for speed. There is base levels of strength that are required and that can move the needle forward in terms of being faster. So you need to be strong enough to actually produce force. And very weak athletes, that's why strength training immediately makes them faster, because they're not strong enough to produce that force. So if you only train that, you're leaving portions of that force velocity curve untapped. So if you only train maximal strength, you only lift heavy weights slowly, you're training one end of that force velocity curve. You're building a foundation with basically nothing on top of it. That foundation is important, but once you've got the foundation, now we got to start to actually build something on the foundation to actually have a house. So you need to train the rate at which you produce force, not just the maximum amount of force that you can produce. This is where exercises like the weightlifting-based stuff or Olympic lifts, like the snatch and the clean and jerk, can come into play. The clean, the snatch, and the jerk, these movements all require you to accelerate a heavy barbell with high velocities. You're training that middle zone of the force velocity curve. You're training power with those lifts. That's why the weightlifting movements are so popular in sport and athletic development. And the research on this is very clear that the Olympic lifts have one of the highest power outputs of any exercise you can do in the gym. They teach your nervous system to recruit motor units quickly and to produce force rapidly. But we have to remember, it's not just the Olympic lifts. There's other things you can do. Plyometrics are also absolutely essential for speed development. Plyometrics are exercises where you're going to use the stress shortening cycle that we kind of talked about earlier. Different box jumps, depth drops, bounds, hops, pogos, all these exercises train reactive-based strength. They train your muscles and tendons to act like springs that store and release energy rapidly. And when you do a depth drop, for example, or depth jump, you step off the box, you land, and you immediately explode back up, sometimes over an object, sometimes back on another box, maybe just up as high as you possibly can. You're spending minimal time on the ground. You're training your body to produce force in the exact time frames that actually matter for sprinting and running fast. So you can have resistance sprints, sled pushes, sled pulls, hill sprints. These exercises are training something specific that's crucial for acceleration. They're training horizontal force production. So when you sprint, especially when you're accelerating, you're not pushing straight down into the ground. You're actually pushing backwards, and then you're pushing horizontally to move your body forward in space. The direction of your force matters enormously when it comes to actually running fast. A lot of athletes have great vertical jump ability, and they might be able to jump high, but their vertical jump doesn't always correlate with the sprint speed, because jumping is about producing vertical force. Sprinting, especially the acceleration phase of sprinting, is about producing horizontal force. Yes, there will be overlap. Typically, an athlete that can jump higher is probably going to jump faster, but not always, right? We know that basketball players can jump out of the ground or jump out of the gym, but they're not running the fastest 100 meter times. So being able to produce that force in the direction that you need to is somewhat specific to being able to run faster and or jump higher. This is why your shin angle matters so much when it comes to sprinting. When you're accelerating, you want your shin to be almost vertical, perpendicular to the ground. This allows you to push backward into the ground more effectively. If your shin angle is forward, your foot lands in front of your body, and then you're producing a braking force. So you're literally slowing yourself down with every single step. But if your shin is vertical or even angled slightly backwards, all of your force is going to go into propelling you forward in space. Okay? So heavy sled work is very popular for this, because if you think about it, when you go to actually push a sled, you're already leaning forward, probably very similar to the same angle that you're going to when you're sprinting, especially the acceleration phase of sprinting. So when you push or even pull a sled, if you happen to have the straps over you or you happen to have the strap around your waist, you're forced into that forward lean position. You have to push your legs back into the ground to be able to overcome the resistance of the sled. You're training the exact same force vector in the exact direction of force production that actually matters for acceleration. And because it's heavy, because there's more resistance than you would if you didn't have a sled to push, you're training strength at the bottom of the force velocity curve. But because you're still trying to move as fast as possible, you're also training power. So obviously, if you have the sled load up as heavy as you can and you can barely move it, that's not going to train that power. So there is a sweet spot. But usually for most people, if you just put a light to moderate amount of weight on a sled and sprint as fast as you can, you're going to be in that power development phase of the force velocity curve. There's also another interesting training method called contrast training. I've got a whole episode on YouTube about this as well. And this is where you pair a heavy strength exercise with an explosive power exercise. So for example, you might do a heavy squat. Let's just say 3 to 5 reps at like 80 to 85% of your one rep max. And then immediately follow it with a set of vertical jumps or a short duration sprint, 5 or 10 yards. The theory behind this is that it's, you know, it's not like backed by research, but is that the heavy lift creates something called post-activation potentiation. And then your nervous system is all basically fired up and amped up from the heavy weights. And then your motor units are recruited. And now when you do the explosive or fast movement, you can now express even more power than you normally could than if you would just do it as a standalone exercise. So I've used this method with many athletes. And when it's done correctly, it works awesome. I do think there's a minimum training age. You can't just throw somebody new into it. I also think you probably don't need to do that to get them faster or more explosive. But if athletes got a decent amount of training time in the weight room, just the conditioning room, post-activation potentiation and contrast-based training methods work fantastic. But the thing you have to understand is that the heavy lift can't actually be fatiguing. Okay, it needs to be heavy enough to create a neural stimulation. They should still try to move the weight with good intent, but also not so heavy or high enough volume that you're actually metabolically exhausted from the strength piece. This usually means keeping the reps lower, usually in that 2, 3, maybe up to 5 reps at the absolute most, and taking adequate rest before you go to the explosive movement, usually anywhere from 1 minute or 2 minutes before you go to do that explosive movement. I don't think you want to rest too long, but you also don't have to go immediately from the heavy squat and immediately into the box jump. You can give yourself some time to collect yourself, move to the next station, and then go perform it. Now, I'm going to talk about something as well that doesn't get nearly enough attention, and that's the difference between concentric strength and eccentric strength. Now, concentric is when the muscle actually shortens, and your eccentric is when the muscle lengthens under tension. So when you sprint, your hamstrings have to work eccentrically. They have to lengthen while producing force to decelerate your leg at the bottom of each stride. So if your eccentric strength is lacking, you're at high risk for hamstring strains. We see this a lot in high-level sprinters or high-level athletes, especially if they're not sprinting frequently enough, which is one of the most common injuries for people that actually run really fast or speed-based sports. And this is where exercises like Nordic hamstring curls or the inverse curl, maybe even glute ham raises can come in. These exercises specifically train eccentric hamstring strength, especially the Nordics, because you're going with the eccentric base first. And the research on Nordics is very well backed. We know that it works. And we know that teams that implement the Nordic hamstring curl see significant reductions in their hamstring injury rates. But not just beyond the injury prevention side, the eccentric strength also contributes to the force production. And the stiffer your muscles and tendons can be during the eccentric phase, the more energy that they can store to release during the concentric phase. So let's kind of bring this all together into like practical understanding. So to develop speed, you need to train across the entire force velocity curve basically all year round. You need to do stuff that's fast and explosive. You need to train power, and you need to train your general strength. But if your goal is to run as fast as possible or be as fast and explosive as possible, assuming that you've got a general strength training foundation already established, your emphasis should be more on power and rate of force development if it's to optimize speed. You need maximal strength work to build that foundation. So your squats, your deadlifts, your split squats, but you also have to have explosive power-based work. That's where your weightlifting-based movements, so your snatch and your clean and jerk, med ball throws, and plyometrics come in. You need specific speed work where you're actually moving at high velocities. So resistance sprints for your acceleration-based work and also drilling the mechanics of that. Maximum velocity sprints for your top end speed. So actually getting up into your top end speed. So 100-meter sprints, being able to actually get into that, that top end velocity. All of these are pieces of the puzzle to actually running fast. The mistake that too many people make is they pick one end of the spectrum and just focus on that one end of the spectrum. They either just lift heavy or they just use sprints. Again, going back to this, you've got to touch all aspects of that force velocity curve to really maximize all of your speed and power development to the best of your ability. And I think it's pretty obvious if you look at really good quality training programs, they usually do touch on all places of the force velocity curve during either the same session or even within the same training week, depending upon your training philosophy and what you believe would be the best way to optimize your training. And of course, that's going to be athlete dependent and even dependent, depending upon what you have access to. So you need to build a wide base of strength and then learn to express that strength rapidly. And then that's going to be your power and speed relationship, basically in a nutshell. Okay, now we're going to move into technical efficiency. So we've kind of talked about the neural side of speed and power. And I'm trying to think about how to put this. But even if you even have the optimal neural drive, you've developed it to develop that explosive power, you can still be slow if your technique sucks. And this is why we have to talk about technique, because technical efficiency can be that hidden piece behind your speed that's actually holding you back. So let's take a look at like two athletes who are identical in basically every measurable way. They have the same strength numbers. They produce the same power output on force plates. Their neural drive is pretty comparable, but one of them runs, say, a 4.4 second 40-yard dash, and the other runs at 4.7. Okay, not a big difference, but 0.3 could be the difference, especially at the athletic level, especially we're talking about high school and college. So what's the difference? That more than likely, I would say probably 90% of the time, if I had to guess, that it's going to be technique, assuming we take genetics out of the equation. It's going to be technique. It's going to be how biomechanically efficient the other athlete is compared to the other one. One athlete is clearly losing energy somewhere through their poor technique, and the other is actually taking that energy and they're being more optimal with it into their ability to get forward and as fast as possible. So technique in sprinting is very similar to aerodynamics in a car. So you can have the most powerful engine, but if your car does not have good aerodynamics, so it's built like a brick, like, you know, good old fashioned muscle car, you're not necessarily going to go too fast. But if you have poor technique, that's going to basically be your drag, so to speak, in terms of slowing you down. So it creates braking forces and resistance, and it's wasted motion to some degree, and every bit of wasted energy, when we talk about speed, means that you're going to be slower. So let's kind of talk about ground contact times, because this is what's important when it comes to technical aspects and technical factors of running fast. So elite sprinters, when they're at their maximum velocity, spend less than 0.1 seconds on the ground per step. They're barely touching the ground before they're airborne again. And compare that to an untrained person who might spend 0.2 or even 0.3 seconds on the ground. That doesn't sound like a whole lot, but over the course of a sprint, those fractions of a second actually add up to be massive differences in terms of the performance that you're seeing on the track or maybe the field. So it's not just about being on the ground for a shorter period amount of time. It's about what you're doing during the ground contact time. The direction of force application is also important. We've kind of already talked about this a little bit, but the direction of the force that's being applied is going to be massive when it comes to running as fast as possible. So when your foot hits the ground, you need to be pushing backward and not down. We've kind of talked about this. You need to be applying a force horizontally to propel yourself forward, not just supporting your body weight. And the concept of stiffness versus compliance comes in. So your leg needs to act like the stiff spring, not a soft cushion. So when your foot hits the ground, you don't want your ankle collapsing, your knee buckling, your hip flexing. You want minimal give throughout your lower body aspect or your lower body chain of the sprinting portion of the mechanics. You want to be stiff and reactive so that you can bounce off the ground. And you think about like taking a basketball or a beanbag, the basketball is pretty stiff, right? It's got the ability that it bounces. And a beanbag is soft and it just duns on the floor. So your leg needs to be more like a basketball. It needs to be stiff and be able to recoil energy back up so that you can take your next step and continue moving forward. And another thing that people get confused, because in other contexts we talk about shock absorption and cushioning, but when it comes to sprinting, that cushioning that we talked about with the beanbag is actually a bad thing, obviously. So you want just enough muscle activation to obviously stabilize your joints. And then you want to be normally ideally as stiff as possible to maximize that spring effect. And this is trainable through, again, plyometrics and proper sprint technique. So now that we understand that, let's talk about the body and the posture and the position, because this is where you usually see the effort in the technical side of sprinting. So your posture when you sprint will determine just about everything for the most part. I mean, you got to think about it. The angles that you're sprinting is going to dictate the muscle that you're able to use, how you're going to apply that force into the ground, and where it's actually going to push you in space. So if your posture is off, or your technical positioning is off, nothing else really matters in terms of being able to optimize everything. So you could be the strongest of the sprinters. You could be the more powerful athlete in terms of the testing. But if your position is off, chances are you're either not putting as much horizontal force on the ground, especially from an acceleration perspective, or you could accidentally be creating more braking forces while you're running versus more propulsive-based forces. And that's going to obviously slow you down. So the ideal sprint posture has a couple pretty key and must-do characteristics to optimize your speed and your performance. First, you need obviously a slight forward lean from the ankles, not the waist, especially if you're going from a standing position. A lot of people misunderstand this. They think that they got to bend their whole body all the way over forward. You actually kind of want to lean forward on your feet. I really like falling sprints for this, to be able to teach athletes how to get their whole body forward, especially the younger ones. So they usually bend at the waist and their torso leans forwards when their hips stay back. That's not what we actually call a true forward lean. That's just poor posture. The forward leans need to come from the ankles. Your entire body, from your ankles to your head, should be in a straight line when you go to that forward lean before you actually go to take off. And then that straight line should be slightly angled forward. That's going to create the optimal shin angle and force direction that we talked about from like a standing position. We're going to be leaning the whole body forward. You're not going to push your butt back first to just go this way. You want your whole body to start to go forward together, and that's going to get everything going in the right direction first. Then obviously your pelvis needs to be ideally in as a neutral position as you can get it. Some athletes are going to have compensations here, but ideally it would be as neutral as the body can have it. So a lot of those that usually have sit or have poor hip mobility, they run with more of an anterior pelvic tilt. The best athletes will probably have somewhat of an anterior pelvic tilt because their body has adapted to high speeds. So I will tell you that. But obviously, as you're trying to get faster and you don't have hip mobility issues, you want to try to avoid those as much as you possibly can to obviously stay healthy. But it will try to optimize your mechanics as much as you can. But the highest athletes, highest performing and fastest athletes in the world will likely have some anterior pelvic tilt, more so than what the body naturally has, which would be the quote-unquote neutral. But for some athletes, their hips are usually too far forward, their lower back is arched, and then they can't get their glutes to fire as effectively. So this can be a negative from a sprint mechanics, but again, you're going to see different body types and different shapes make it work. So the reason we say that, though, is because your glutes are your primary hip extensors, and they're going to give you that big power output. They are incredibly strong. And so if you can't optimize your glutes because your pelvis is out of position, then obviously you could be running a lot slower. So just keep that in mind. Third thing from a technical position perspective is going to be your head. Where your head goes, your body follows. So if you're looking down at the ground and your neck is flexed too much, that flexion tends to create flexion throughout your whole spine. We don't want that. So your whole back's kind of rounded. Your hips drop, your stride shortens, and then you lose power. Your head needs to be in a neutral position or pretty close to it. Your eyes looking at the horizon. Okay. Imagine that there's like a string attached to the top of your head, pulling you up and forward, getting you long. That's a good way to teach this, is to get as long as you can. As you're sprinting, you probably see those nice, good pictures of people leaning forward, knee, opposite arm coming up. They look like a nice straight line from their head all the way down into their foot. That's what you ideally want to have and what it should kind of feel like. Now we're going to talk about arm action, because I think this is something that is really undertrained. It's underappreciated. And youth athletes especially have a hard time understanding arm action. Your arms drive your legs. Okay, it's not a metaphor. That's just the basic gait cycle. Okay, that's how you should walk. If your left leg comes forward, your right arm's coming forward. Okay, same thing when you run. You'd be amazed at how many kids that I work with go to sprint. They bring their left leg forward and their left arm forward. You know what that does? That turns your whole body to the right. We don't want to do that. You don't want to make a right-hand turn. It's also not optimal. But it's basic biomechanics. That's all it is. It's basic biomechanics. The rhythm and the power of your swing, your arm swing in particular, affects the rhythm and power of your leg drive. That's usually what I say. If you want fast legs, you got to have fast arms. We always talk about the hands going from face to butt. I've always learned to teach it from hips to nips. So when your arms are moving, your hand is coming from your hip pocket all the way up to your nipples. That's what I use with the kids. Or I also teach them too, especially the really little ones. I usually like to say nips or nipples. I'll say, you got to pretend like you're washing your butt and you're washing your head. You're washing your butt and you're washing your head. Okay. So the proper arm mechanics are going to have a couple key points here. They should swim forward and back, not side to side. That's another big issue that we see with kids. They bring their arms across their body, not bringing them forward and back. They bring the arm across their midline, and then their hands come across their body. This creates rotation throughout the torso, and we do want some natural rotation, but again, bringing the arm across the midline is going to create more of a quote-unquote energy leak, for lack of a better way to put it. Your arm swing should be straight forward, straight back, just like a, like I said, hips to nips or like a piston. So your elbow should be bent at roughly 90 degrees, a little bit more. Most, you'll see different things coached, but around that 90 degree range is a good place to start. But somewhere in that neighborhood, too straight, and you're going to lose the mechanical advantage of having obviously a short, you mean, you have a longer lever, but in this case, you don't want a longer lever because you want to be able to move your arms as quickly as you can. But if you're too bent, you're wasting energy moving your arms through a short range of motion. So it's got to be a big enough range of motion, but you don't want your arms super long to where you've got that really long lever. Your hands should be relatively relaxed. You might see them kind of run with clenched fists. Ideally, you're going to see, if you're happening to be watching on YouTube, if not, your hand is almost like open like a five, like you're making the number five. That's how I usually teach kids to do it. That way I know that their hands are relaxed. They don't have to be, you know, with your fingers all together. And then they're going to have them obviously then create tension in their forearms if they are making a fist. Their shoulders would be up by their ears. They're kind of shrugging while they're doing it. Again, you don't want that. Your shoulders should become somewhat relaxed. Tension in the upper body is a speed killer because it makes you kind of run or move like a refrigerator, as I've gotten from Mike Robertson. So you want the arms aggressive, powerful swing of the arms, but the hands are relatively relaxed. Shoulders are relatively relaxed so that you're not shrugging up. A good quote that I've heard in the past, I wish I could tell you who I got it from, was to pretend like you're running with a bag of potato chips in your hand, right? You can't squeeze the bag of potato chips. I mean, you don't have to make a fist either, but you don't want to squeeze the bag of potato chips because you'll break them all. So your hand's got to be somewhat relaxed, but you can still actually grab something. That's a good way to think about how your hand should feel. And that's going to get your arms moving in a natural motion without actually having to be too tense, but also not too loose. And so the backswing of your arm is also incredibly important that many athletes kind of forget. They kind of do this little choppy thing. They bend their elbows in front of them. They're not having the big, good arm action, but they're just moving their elbows. They're not really moving their shoulders. That backswing is just as important as a front run, especially for kids and youth athletes that I work with, trying to work on speed development and getting them run faster. You can bring that arm backwards, bring that elbow actually back. The elbow should come back, and it will actually help with your hip extension. And so when your elbow drives back, you're going to see your actual opposite hip come forward. So it's all connected. Now, I kind of want to address a technical debate that comes up a lot, and stride length versus stride frequency. You'll hear it asked all the time, should I be taking longer strides or faster strides? And the answer is yes, you need both. Speed is stride length times stride frequency. So if you increase one without decreasing the other, you get faster. The problem is the two factors often trade off against each other. So the key is finding that optimal combination for the athlete. And it's going to vary individually for every single person because of their limb lengths, their strength levels, and obviously their neuromuscular system. But a general principle that applies to a lot of athletes is most people overthink the stride length and understride their stride frequency. So they try to reach out and take big steps, which actually ends up slowing them down. And this is called overstriding, is probably what you hear it called. And it's one of the most technical faults on the lower body half, is athletes overstriding, especially when we talk about the acceleration aspect or running as fast as possible. Now, when you overstride, your foot actually lands out in front of your body, and you're creating more of a braking-based force, and every step is technically, from a mechanics standpoint, actually slowing you down. Your foot should land approximately underneath your center of mass when you're running, maybe even slightly in front, but not way out in front. So if we were to record an athlete from the side, your foot is landing a full foot or more in front of your hips, you're overstriding, and you're actually decreasing or hurting your ability to run as fast as you possibly can. So instead of trying to make your strides longer, focus on applying force more effectively through your training and how you're running every single step that you're taking. Focus on pushing the ground backwards. That's the best cue, is push backwards into the ground. That will push yourself forwards. Focus on quick ground contacts. And so when you do this, your stride length will naturally kind of take care of itself based upon the force you're producing. You'll cover more ground, not because you're reaching forward more, but because you're actually pushing backward more powerfully, and it's propelling you more forward with every step that you take. And so a technical drill that you can do to help with this is to film yourself sprinting from the side if you have the ability to do so. And, you know, obviously use your cell phone and have someone film you running it close to your maximum speed. Then you're going to watch it back. You probably have to slow-mo it, but watch it back. Look at where your foot is landing relative to your hips. And also at the same time, look at your posture. Look at your arm action. And I guarantee you'll see things that surprise you. You'll probably be identified as the things that we've kind of gone through from a technical list. You'll be able to say, oh, I'm not doing this, or I'm not bringing my elbow back far enough. My hands look kind of tight, right? I'm bringing my arm across my midline. You might start to discover some of these things. But most people think their technique is better than it actually is. And the nice thing is, with the video and the phones that we have, the amount of education that we have and the technology that we have to be able to slow things down, you can see stuff very, very clearly nowadays. So the last technical point I want to make is about energy leaks. And these are the movements or positions that waste energy. So excessive rotation through your torso is energy leak. We've kind of talked about already. Tension within your muscles that aren't contributing to any movement, that's an energy leak. Poor ankle stiffness, where your ankle collapses on the ground, especially from like an overpronated foot, that's an energy leak. Lazy or inefficient arm action, that's an energy leak. All these little inefficiencies will add up to decreased sprinting times. So you got to kind of think about this when we go back to our car analogy, that you've got a leak in your gas tank. You might have a full tank, but you might have a full engine or a powerful engine. Excuse me, like that V8 that we talked about. But if you're losing gas, you're not very aerodynamic, Okay, you're not going to get very far in terms of the power output and being able to do it sustainably, especially over a long period amount of time, especially if you have to do multiple sprints. If you have a sport, say, like basketball or soccer or something like that, where you got to cover a good amount of ground from a sprinting perspective over the course of your sport, it's always going to leave you feeling like you're behind. And so that technical efficiency is about increasing the ability to be more biomechanically efficient while you're running, and that's going to be able to let you be more optimal as you're sprinting and changing direction, all that kind of things. So you want to make sure that every bit of energy that you're producing is actually going to move you forward in space in terms of a max effort sprinting and speed development, not into wasted motion that you're doing through your sprint development. And so it's why technique work needs to always be a consistent part of your training. You need to do drills. You need to do technical runs at sub-maximal speeds where you're focusing on executing great sprint mechanics. Your high effort work also needs to focus on sprint mechanics. You pick the drills that are going to fit the athlete to fix the need. So if you need more lower body drills to work on your lower body mechanics, you do that. If you need arm action stuff, you do arm action drills. Film yourself if you happen to be sprinting like out on a track. Speed is a skill, and just like any other skill, it's going to require deliberate practice to develop. You can't just show up and run hard and expect your technique to improve on its own. You actually have to work on it intentionally. And if you watch high-level sprinters, very fast people, part of their general warm-ups when they're doing their sport are general sprint mechanic drills. It's not only great from a preparatory standpoint, it not only gets the tendons feeling good, it increases the body temperature, gets the athlete mentally and physically ready for sport, but it's also ingraining more improved sprint mechanics. Okay, one of the final things I want to talk about here is the mental component of speed. And I don't think it gets enough love in speed development, and it is psychological. So I'm not going to talk about like motivation psychology of having a good attitude during running. Like, yes, you should have a good attitude with any kind of training that you want to have, but I'm talking about more about the mental state and the ability to directly impact your ability to express that speed, because speed is going to require your mental presence. It requires a specific type of mental state. And for most athletes, this mental component is the missing piece that's holding them back from expressing their full physical potential. They may be powerful. They may be strong. They may have some pretty damn good running technique, but maybe they're missing the mental piece. And so the first one would be the paradox of just trying too damn hard. You've probably seen it all the time in sports where you're about to go do something and you put in as much effort as you possibly can, like maybe in like a game or a sprint or a competition or whatever. You're fired up, and then you go and you're not as fast as you thought you could be. You know, you feel tight, you feel slow, okay? The tension is what's actually killing you. We talked about, you know, the clenched fist. You know, if you're too tense, you're not going to be able to run as fast as you can. That's why that you kind of hear this coin of run loose, feel relaxed, athletic, you know, move freely. Those are the things of like reducing that tension. And so when you try too hard and you think about it too much, then, you know, you get too caught up mentally, and it'd be able to create that physical tension. And then your muscles tense up, your shoulders rise, right? You got the clenched jaws, your breathing's not optimal. All that can interfere with smooth, coordinated, athletic, explosive-based movement. To be fast, you got to have. You got to be able to relax to some degree and be mentally okay with just vegging out and not putting a lot of pressure on yourself, especially if you're talking about running a straight line like a track event. So most elite sprinters also call this relaxed effort or smooth speed. Right. It sounds contradictory, but you know, how can you be relaxed when you're running as fast as you possibly can? It's not necessarily being physically relaxed all the time, but it's about being free of unnecessary tension, letting the movement happen rather than trying to force it. Just kind of just run, I guess, the best way to kind of put it. Okay. A good analogy here would be like if you think about a cat. And then pouncing, the cat doesn't tense up and strain when it pounces. It's kind of fluid. It's smooth. It's effortless. It just looks like they're floating as they jump to the air. Looks explosive and powerful. And that optimal speed looks like, okay, there's a mass amount of force being produced, but there's no wasted tension or movement. Okay. It's incredibly difficult to teach. I will admit that, especially with youth athletes. it's even more difficult to learn because it is somewhat of a paradox. You have to care deeply about the outcome while also letting go of the attachment to the outcome. You've got to try hard while also not trying too hard. It's a balance. It's very razor edge thin. And the only way to find that edge is through experience of doing sprints, especially at the competitive level or at the sport level or through competitive-based practice, learning that state feels like of running loose and free, but still with a lot of effort. Now, this is where visualization and mental rehearsal can help. So there's awesome research showing that your nervous system can't really distinguish between vivid imagination movement and actual movement. So when you visualize yourself sprinting with great technique, moving fast, your brain fires many of the same neural pathways that would fire if you're actually doing the competitive endeavor or running as fast as you possibly can. So we know that at the Olympic level that elite sprinters are using a visualization extensively. You can see it before a race. They'll mentally rehearse what's going on. They're kind of like look like they're running when they're doing the running mechanics. You can see it in the blocks. They're thinking about taking their deep breaths, getting set in. You know, they're going to try to feel the gun go off. They're trying to put themselves in that position, not only during the race, but also obviously nights before in the mental rehearsal piece. They try to go through it step by step, right? They'll see themselves doing their warm-up, getting in the block, the gun going off if they're happening, like doing a sprint, for example. They're going to see the stride. They're going to see themselves executing good technique, feeling smooth and powerful, okay? They're actually mentally practicing it. They're grooving the neural pathways. They're just preparing their mind and their performance just upstairs. And I've read some great books on this in my sports psych stuff in grad school. We actually had to make our own recording and rehearsal of mental imagery and then basically listen to it. And at the time, I was competing in powerlifting, so I made it in terms of squatting and listened to it over and over. And you would be amazed if you truly sit down and actually use stuff like that. You really got to buy into it. But I'm telling you, if you actually put a lot of effort into it, especially from an athletic performance perspective, you can put yourself in that position and you can feel the exact same way that you would in a competition, but you got to really sit down and focus on it. But sprinting is a great way to have using mental visualization to be able to improve your performance without actually having to do it, because we know what sprinting should look like. People that want to get better at sprinting have probably watched enough and they know what the proper mechanics look like, and you can practice that from a mental perspective. So you can use this as part of your training. You know, you can do it the day before a speed session or the morning before or whatever, before you actually take that time and run, before you take the actual run itself. You know, you're doing your warm-up while you're doing your sprint mechanic-based work as part of your warm-up. That's a great time to do it. You don't want to visualize the negative pieces. So you don't visualize struggling or being slow or watching go wrong. You're visualizing the optimal, most high-end, perfect performance that you've ever put together. You want to see it. You want to feel it. You want to make it as vivid as possible. So that's just mental rehearsal. It's another day of running your fastest race you ever had in terms of like a track performance. The same thing for any other sport. Okay, now I want to kind of talk about confidence and fear, because these are emotional states that have enormous impacts on speed. Fear, so even subconscious fear, creates unconscious braking mechanisms. If you're afraid of getting injured, if you're afraid of falling, you're afraid of looking stupid, your brain will not allow you to express your full speed, and it will hold you back as a protective-based mechanism. That's why we say you can't think about getting injured. We talk about athletic-based injuries or coming back from an injury. You can't think about that. It will hold you back. So they might be physically ready, but the injury might be healed up, but there's still a lingering fear, there's hesitation, and that fear shows up as reduced speed, reduced performance. They can't think, even though they can't consciously feel themselves being held back, the body knows what's going on. It's subconsciously there. So building that confidence requires progressive exposure. You can't just decide to not be afraid. You obviously have to prove to yourself through your nervous system that everything's going to go great, it's going to be fast, gradually increasing your intensity. You build up the speed progressively over weeks and months. As you're getting that return to play protocol, practice at those speeds at low stakes environments, right? In controlled settings, so that when the high stake ones come, the speed feels familiar, You're not scared. It's just another walk in the park from what you've already been practicing. I think self-talk is also important here as well. The way you talk to yourself inside affects your physiology. We know that telling yourself, "You don't mess up," your body tenses. But if you tell yourself, "I'm fast, I'm quick, I'm powerful, I'm explosive," you're more likely to feel those qualities. Okay. It's not voodoo or whatever. It is rooted in some kind of neuroscience. The words you use, you want to use positive self-talk. Okay. It's positive self-talk. You want to use descriptive words as you're talking to yourself that enhance performance. Okay. Positive things, quick, fast, powerful, explosive. You don't want to use "don't get hurt," "don't be slow." Okay. Those words still have negative repercussions. Use the positive aspect of it. That's why it's called positive self-talk. Okay, we're going to talk about some attentional focus. So research shows that when you direct your attention, where you direct your attention actually affects your performance. There's two types of attention focus. There's the internal focus, where you focus on your body and what your muscles are doing. And there's the external focus, where you focus on the effect of the movement on the environment. So for speed, external focus is almost always better, because if I were to tell you to push the ground away versus contract your glutes, the external cue, push the ground away, will typically produce better results. Most people aren't going to have anatomy and physiology-based backgrounds when it comes to actually coaching other athletes. When you're working with your athletes, they're not going to have that. So you want to give them the external focus, because that will get you what you want to have happen from a physiological perspective or a biomechanical perspective. Okay, so your brain is really good at figuring out how to accomplish the external goal, because it's more realistic. You see people do that. You don't watch somebody contract their glute. Right? It's not as good as consciously controlling individual muscles when we talk about coaching cues. And sprinting is no different, especially when we're talking about the technical side. So coaching cues do matter, and a language as a coach can help or hurt performance. Run fast is a better coaching cue than move your legs faster. Drive your arms or improve your arm action is better than contract your deltoids and your triceps. Okay, external action-oriented cues produce more fluid, automatic, athletic-based movement. So that brings me to the concept of flow state. So I read this book. I think it's called Flow, if I remember correctly. And you know that feeling when everything is clicking, when movement feels effortless, when you're performing your best without thinking about it. That's flow. And while we can't force flow to happen, we can create conditions that make it more likely. Flow happens when challenge and skill are balanced. Too easy, you're bored. Too hard, you're anxious. Right in the middle, you're in flow. Flow happens when you're completely present, not thinking about the past or the future. It's being in the moment. So you have clear goals, immediate feedback. All these conditions can be designed into your training. So the mental component of speed is about getting your conscious mind out of the way, letting your unconscious competence, athletic-based skill take over. Trust your body to know what it's going to do. It's just running at the end of the day. Be present, have confidence, and you will be faster. So it's not that this is like softness-based stuff. I've seen athletes that are incredibly talented, but when it comes time to perform, they get tense, they overthink. All the physical preparation itself cannot be expressed. So the mental component is real just for anything, but especially when it comes to sprinting and we think about it from a track perspective or a time perspective or being able to perform well at high levels or at high stake events, the mental side can kill athletes from being positive about their athletic performance. Okay, now we're going to talk about sport-specific speed. And I think this is pretty critical, and that's that not all speed is created equal. The speed demands of a 100-meter sprinter are totally different from the speed demands of like a soccer player, which are also different from a basketball player, which are different from a tennis player. When we talk about developing speed, we have to ask ourselves, what is the speed going to be used for? Okay, what are the specific demands of the sport, and how do we tailor training to meet those demands? So kind of stuck with the most obvious distinction, and that's just straight up linear speed versus multidirectional speed. Linear speed is clearly just straightforward. It's running a straight line as fast as you possibly can, and this is what track athletes do. This is what wide receivers do if they're running a go route. Linear speed can be broken down into acceleration, maximum velocity, and speed endurance, but it's all still in that one direction, straight forward in a straight line. Now, multidirectional speed is a little more complex. It's going to involve acceleration, deceleration, change direction, reactive-based agility. This is what soccer players need. This is what basketball players need. This is what tennis players need. You're not just running fast. You're stopping, starting, cutting, changing direction, all while maintaining speed and control of your body. And also, these sports usually have an object that you're having to track from a visual perspective. So your force vectors involved in these movements are completely different. When you're decelerating, you need eccentric strength to be able to absorb that force and be able to come to a stop. And when you're changing direction, you need lateral strength and stability. Your ankle, your knee, your hip all need to be able to stabilize the lateral forces. These qualities don't develop from just running sprints. Now let's talk about the acceleration versus maximum velocity because, well, linear speed, these are different qualities. So they're both obviously just running forward and back or, you know, just running a straight line. But acceleration is all about producing horizontal force. It's about your first 3 to 5 steps. It's about your shin angle, your forward lean, your ability to push back into the ground powerfully. Your max velocity, on the other hand, though, is about stride frequency and elastic reactive strength. It's about how quick ground contacts, about being stiff and springy. Most sports are much more dependent on acceleration than maximum velocity. If you think about football, basketball, soccer, lacrosse, how often are you running for more than 20 or 30 yards without stopping, changing direction, or engaging with an opponent or having to make a mental decision? It's not very often. Most of the game is played in the what I would call the acceleration zone. You're going from zero to fast in very short distances. That means that you should be, your training should emphasize acceleration work, not a whole lot of maximum velocity-based work. But now if we talk about speed endurance, because this is critical for sports that require repeated sprints, speed endurance is your ability to maintain high speeds over time to repeat high efforts with minimal recovery. So a 400-meter runner needs incredible speed endurance. A soccer player who has to make 50 to 60 high-intensity runs in a 90-minute game is probably going to need some speed endurance. But here's the thing. Speed endurance is not the same as conditioning or aerobic fitness. Speed endurance is trained with repeated sprint work at high intensities with incomplete recovery. You're not jogging for miles. You're doing something like 10 times 50 meters with 30, 60 seconds rest. You're training your body's ability to clear lactate, to buffer fatigue, to maintain power output, even as metabolic stress accumulates. The energy systems involved are different here as well. So pure speed work uses the alactic system or the phosphagen-based system, depending on how you want to kind of look at it. Same thing. You're using ATP and creatine phosphate as your primary energy source. These deplete quickly, but also recover pretty quickly, which is why pure speed work requires long rest intervals. Speed endurance starts to tap into the lactic system, so you're accumulating lactate. You're dealing with acidosis. This is uncomfortable and it requires different adaptations than pure speed work. So let's talk about the position specific needs because within a single sport, different positions have different speed requirements. So let's take basketball as an example. A point guard needs first step quickness is what I would probably like to call it, I guess. They need to be able to beat a defender in the first 2 steps. They need lateral quickness to stay in front of their man on defense. They need the ability to change direction. A center, on the other hand, might not need elite linear speed, but they need quick feet and tight spaces to be able to jump quickly and repeatedly, and they need reactive quickness in the paint to be able to battle for that position. In football, a wide receiver needs top-end speed to be able to stretch that field out. A running back needs vision, agility, acceleration in all kinds of directions. A linebacker needs that short area quickness, the ability to change direction, well, reading, reacting to the defender or to the offense. A one-size-fits-all speed training doesn't work when the demands are varied for different athletes and even positions in this case, right? This is where agility and reactive speed come into play. And these are skills that are distinct from pure speed. Agility involves a cognitive component. I've not stressed this enough in my career. I feel like agility involves a cognitive component. Got to be up here to some degree. It's not just about moving fast. It's about processing information, You got to make decisions and then moving fast based on those decisions. So a tennis player reading where their opponent is hitting the ball and then accelerating to that spot. A defensive back, DB, reading the receiver's route and reacting to what they're doing. A soccer player seeing a space open up on the pitch and sprinting to it. The cognitive processing speed is trainable. You can improve your ability to read cues, to anticipate, to react quickly. But it does require specific training to be able to do that. You need reactive-based drills to be responding to unpredictable stimuli. You need small-sided games where you're making decisions under time pressure and some much smaller components, or maybe the decisions you're making are happening much quicker than when the field's stretched out. You need film study to be able to improve your pattern recognition and anticipation. That's why film study is so important. If you know like how plays are set up in football, for example, you have an idea of where the ball might go. Not always, but if you have an idea of what to look for, you can make an anticipation to be able to maybe jump a pass route. So the point that I want to hammer here is that you need to train speed in a way that matches the demands of your sport. Okay? So if you're a soccer player and all you do is run straight lines on the track, you're kind of missing the boat of being a better soccer player. You can still be fast, but you're not going to be fast and reactive and agile. Okay. You need to be doing change of direction work. You need to be doing reactive based agility. You need to be training speed in the context of your sport. Now, this is also important, but you need some general speed development. Okay. If you're a soccer player who needs multidirectional speed, there's still value in developing linear speed, you know, especially the acceleration side and even some maximum velocity. These qualities still provide a foundation, but a faster athlete in a straight line has more speed potential to redirect in different directions. So the answer isn't to never do straight line speed work. The answer is to be balanced in general speed development with specific speed development, depending upon what your weaknesses are and where you can stand to improve. So this is where training gear and periodization come in. In the off season, you might do more general speed work, building that foundation, focusing on maximum velocity a little bit, improving your sprint mechanics. And as you get closer to season, your speed work becomes much more specific. You get closer towards focusing on more acceleration-based work, more directional-based work, more reactive-based stuff, with the technical and tactical demands of your sport also sprinkled in, because now you're going to be getting a lot more soccer ball work in. By the time you're in season, most of your speed work is happening within your sport-specific training competition, and maybe this is just some maintenance work to keep your physical quality sharp, or if you happen to not see as much playing time, that maybe you're not a starter, you're not getting as much actual sprinting as you were during the practices or preseason, then you do some stuff to kind of maintain that. So when you're called up, you're ready to go. Now, the key takeaway here that I want you to understand is this, that speed is not just one thing. It's a collection of related but distinct qualities. Your job, especially as a coach or an athlete, is to figure out what types of speed matter most for your sport in your position, and then structure your training to develop those qualities systematically. You don't just copy what the track sprinter is doing. If you're a soccer player, I've seen this even at the football level, football players and coaches will get track athlete workouts. You're not a track athlete, you're a football player. Train like a football player. Doesn't mean you can't take some pieces away to improve your linear acceleration, for example, to run fast in a straight line, but most of the football players aren't running fast in a straight line, okay? You need to be specific. You got to be intentional to some degree. You got to train the type of speed that you actually need to perform your best. Okay, now let's get to some programming for speed development. So we kind of covered the why. Let's get into the how. How do you actually structure your training to maximize speed development? How do you put together a program that's systematic, progressive, develops speed over time without burning you out or getting you injured? This is where programming comes in. This is where a lot of athletes and even coaches make critical mistakes. So let me start with a fundamental principle that needs we guide everything else, and that's periodization. Periodization is just the systematic planning of training to achieve peak performance at the right time. You cannot develop all the physical qualities all at one go. You cannot just train maximal strength, power, speed, endurance, and conditioning all maximally all at the same time. I want to be clear. You can't do them all maximally. They're ebbs and flows. Your body doesn't have the adaptive capacity to go in on all those 100% of the time, all the time. Okay, you'll just end up mediocre at everything and you'll eventually burn out, aka CrossFit. There's my subtle jab. So instead, you divide your training into year into phases. In each phase, focus a little bit more on certain qualities. So your general preparation phase, early in the offseason, you're building work capacity. You're building a base level of strength. You're addressing movement limitations. You're doing high volumes of work. Your speed work in this phase might be more about technique and rhythm than always all-out maximum intensity. You still run hard. You still run fast, but focusing more on technique. Then you can be more a specific preparation phase, mid to late off season. You're shifting your emphasis towards power and explosive strength. Your strength work is still there, but now you're maybe adding in some more Olympic lifts, more plyometrics, more intense speed work. You're reducing the total volume hypertrophy work that you normally were doing in the other part of the off season. You're getting more specific to the demands of the sport. And then as you move into the competition phase or the in-season part of your training, the volume decreases pretty significantly. You're maintaining your strength. You're still strength training hard, but you're focused more on maintaining than anything else and trying to build and improve that power if you can with lower volumes. Most of your speed work is happening at practice competition, so you're not trying to make huge gains during the season in terms of the speed side. You still got to run hard at times, but you're not going to have those stupid high efforts like you were in the offseason or even part of the preseason. You're trying to maintain what you build in the offseason and trying to stay as fresh as you possibly can. And if you can make some performance during the season, that's great. But if not, maintaining everything will do great if you put in the work in the offseason. The progression from general specific, from high volume to high intensity, from building into maintaining, this is periodization. And it's not optimal. It's fundamental. You know, you've got to try to max out your speed work and your strength work and your conditioning work all at the same time. You're going to plateau and you're going to break down. So let's kind of talk about some weekly training structure, because how you organize your week could matter pretty enormously. But the single most important rule for speed training is speed work comes first. We talked about this earlier. Speed work's got to come first. Okay. Not first after do your general warm up, but after you're warmed up, now it's time to actually sprint hard. You can do it beginning of the week as well, so you're also as fresh as possible. But speed work requires your maximum freshness, your central nervous system. If your nervous system's fatigued, you cannot express or train that true speed. Now, here's what a typical training week might look like for an athlete in their off season from a speed development side. Monday, you do your primary speed and acceleration work, so you're fresh coming off the weekend. Your certain nervous system's recovered, so you can do your maximum intensity sprints, your acceleration work, your max velocity work. After your speed work, you might do some power work, Olympic lifts, med ball throws, things like that at high intensity, but don't require the same level of neural freshness as sprinting. Tuesday, you can also make that a strength day with an emphasis on the lower body. So you're doing your squats, your deadlifts, your single leg work. The intensity is still high, but it's a different type of intensity than Monday. You can also put Monday morning as a sprint, Monday evening as the heavy lower body. You can also do that as well if you need to get some days together. So you're not asking your nervous system to fire as fast as possible, but you're trying to build some general strength. So you're training, you're splitting your qualities up basically here. And then Wednesday is more of a recovery day. Light conditioning day, blood flow work, things like that. Maybe some light tempo runs, if anything. Maybe doing something in the pool, maybe mobility work. Whatever you're doing, just kind of veg out and get the blood flowing. Thursday, you're back to more speed work, but maybe a different emphasis than Monday. So since Monday was maybe more of acceleration, maybe Thursday is now more of a max velo day, or Monday was maybe a little more linear speed. Thursday could be change of direction. You know, you can mix those stimuluses up however you want. But after your speed work, you do some more plyometrics, box jumps, whatever. Just so that you're relatively fresh. Friday could be another strength day, maybe a little more of upper body emphasis with a little bit lighter of lower body work. Weekend, typically rest or maybe doing something recovery related there. The thing I want you to see here is that you're training speed early in the week, speed early in the session, and you're allowing for added recovery between your high intensity nervous system work. So you're not just doing speed work on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. You're doing it Monday and Thursday with a little more recovery. This 48 to 72 hour recovery period is pretty crucial from our nervous system perspective. Now, the volume intensity guidelines for speed work, because this is where people go wrong all the time, is that speed work is not about volume, it's about quality. Typical speed sessions might have a total volume of somewhere between 300 and 600 meters, and that's it. Okay. Might be 6 to 12 repetitions of something like 40 to 60 meters and full recovery between your reps. I see full recovery, I mean full recovery. You should let your body get to about 95 to 100% recovered before your next rep. For shorter sprints, that might be a walk back to naturally give you a 1 to 10 or 1 to 15 work to rest ratio, which is kind of what's recommended. For those longer sprints, you might need even 3 to 5 minutes between your reps. And it's going to seem like a lot initially, but when you're doing nothing, it's boring. But trust me, that's how you train speed. You have to have recovery. Short rest does not do this. you end up training conditioning, not speed. So every rep should be run about 95 to 100% effort, whatever you're doing, max effort sprints, not 80, not 85, maybe some 90 ones, but maximum effort anytime you're actually trying to develop speed. You're trying to run as hard as you possibly can, and that's what we actually want. You notice that your times are slowing down from rep to rep. If you're doing more than 5% slower than your best rep for that day, a lot of time it's a good time to shut it down. Your nervous system's fatigued, and being able to continue to run is kind of counterproductive on the speed side. That's basically going to say, hey, now at this point, you're training conditioning. Now, let's talk about the exercise selection and progression, because not all speed exercises are created equal. They need to be progressed systematically. So for resistance-based sprints, you start with light sleds, 10 to 20% of your body weight at the most. It allows you to still run with relatively normal mechanics while still providing resistance. As you adapt, you start to add more weight, but there is a limit. You do not want to have so much weight added that your mechanics go out the window. The goal is to challenge the system while still maintaining your normal speed characteristics and your speed technique. If any of those begin to waver, then the sled or resistance-based work that you're doing is too heavy. Hill sprints are great for developing acceleration mechanics as well, and that horizontal force production. The hill naturally puts you in that forward lean position. It forces you to drive your legs back. You start with moderate inclines, 5 to 10 degrees if you can find one, and much shorter distance than what you would think, and then maybe 20 to 30 meters. And as you get stronger, then you can go steeper or increase that distance, but again, mechanics should stay sound. All right, for assisted sprints, so things like running downhill or overspeed training with bands, these can help with maximum velocity. You're running faster than you normally could, which will then force your nervous system to coordinate the movements at higher speeds. But these need to be used very carefully. I think only elite-level athletes should be using these. The incline can be pretty slight, not very big, and you don't want to use a bunch of like crazy band tension either. Your plyometrics obviously progress from low intensity to higher intensity. You don't start someone who's never done plyometrics with depth drops from like a 40-inch box. That's ridiculous. Start with basics, just bodyweight jumps, broad jumps, box jumps onto a low box, and as they develop their reactive strength and landing mechanics and things like that, then you increase them into more intensive plyometrics with more depth drums, single leg things, and variations, things of that nature. Your strength exercises that are going to transfer into speed and be selecting exercises that have high force, high velocity, or high power characteristics. This is why the Olympic lifts get a big nudge when it comes to improving speed and athleticism, because they check all those boxes. Squats and deadlifts obviously increase your force production. Trap bar jumps, med ball throws, all great. Single leg exercises like your split squats, single leg RDLs, step ups will build unilateral strength, which is great to being a little more specific towards sprinting. Now, you want to monitor all of this, obviously. So you want to track your progress on the weights that you're lifting and the speed that you're running. If you're really trying to go into the speed based lift, for speed, it means timing your sprints ideally. I know it's not going to be ideal to have a timing gate, because they're not exactly the easiest thing to come by. But if you happen to be able to have or train with a buddy or a coach, then obviously you're going to be able to monitor that a little bit better. You want to break to where you test regularly, but not too frequently, maybe every 4 to 12 weeks, depending upon what you're able to do, and then use that to be able to adjust your training and monitor your fatigue. And that will also let you track trends of what's going on with your training. Now, you obviously, besides just the timing, you want to pay attention to your subjective measures. So how you feel, how you're sleeping, how's your appetite, how's your recovery. You know, they're all things you can quickly overtrain by sprinting a lot, lifting heavy, doing a lot of plyometrics. There's a lot that goes into being fast, but there's an art and a science. So the numbers do matter, but you also got to listen to your body, and that's the art of it. So focus on your sleep, focus on your nutrition, getting ample protein, getting ample carbs. These are all normal things. General active recovery, also all incredibly important. Now, before we wrap up, I want to spend just a few minutes talking about common mistakes I see when people are trying to develop speed, because knowing what not to do can sometimes be just as important as what you should do. The number one mistake that I see, though, and this is definitely the most common, is, again, doing the speed where fatigued. So, again, make sure you're doing it at the front of your sessions. You do not want to be tired when you're training your speed. Cannot stress this enough. Mistake number two is neglecting strength development. So, again, you have to have a base level of strength. You don't have to be the strongest guy in the room, but if you're just sprinting and not doing strength development, that will also hinder your speed. So you've got to do some kind of strength development, ideally year-round, and maintaining that base level of strength once you've hit enough. Number three is then going to be ignoring your technique. So again, doing technical-based drills, either as part of your warm-up or different drills throughout the week to focus on what you need, whether that's arm action, knee drive, pushing into the floor, horizontal force production. You will have to do this based upon what you need to get the most out of it. But generally, focusing on different skipping variations, A skips, B skips, high knees, different kind of bounding-based variations are all going to be great for developing usually your coordination and your technique. Number four is going to be not having enough recovery between your speed sessions. So you can't sprint hard every single day of the week. Again, ideally 48 to 72 hours between all your highest efforts. And then in between that, if you want to have recovery runs or light jogging or recovery-based work, that would be great. But again, you don't want to sprint at maximum intensity all every single day, all year round. You do want to sprint all year round, but not every single day. You've got to be able to recover. Number five is neglecting the sport specificity of your sprinting. So again, if you need to change direction, you're going to work in smaller spaces. You need to train to reflect that. If you're just going to run a straight line, your training should more reflect that. If you're going to be able to need to turn around or be able to have speed endurance, then again, you want to make sure that your training can actually reflect that and you're actually training the pieces of your sport that will matter. You still should have a general base at some point. I'm not telling you, you always have to do sport-specific based work. You do need some general sprint training throughout the year. But again, if you need to change direction, you need to work on changing direction. If you're a track athlete, you need to work on linear and you can ignore some of the change direction. Doesn't mean you couldn't do some of it, maybe in the off season, but sports specificity is important if you really do want to maximize your speed and change direction. Number six is then going to be a very small one, but it's going to be the plateau syndrome. Doing the same speed workouts week after week, month after month, your body's going to adapt to that stimuli. So you've got to be able to adapt your training, the distance and the resistance that you're using, the volume, the rest intervals. All these things can be things that you can play with as you get more advanced. Just know that you can't do the same sprint workout every single week for 52 weeks, and continue to see progress. You're going to have to change some stuff. Number seven, the big mistake is, sport coaches, is that they're treating their speed development like conditioning. These are completely different qualities, okay? You cannot train them like that. Conditioning is about sustaining maximal effort for extended periods, where speed is about maximum efforts for brief periods. If you try to train both at the same time with the same methods at high level intensities, you're going to end up in no man's land. You're not going to get faster. You're probably not going to get in better conditioning. And the biggest mistake of all is going to be the overarching error that encompasses many of these others, and that's thinking that speed is just about running hard. Okay, speed is a skill. It is complex, but it is also trainable. It's going to need planning, patience. You're going to have to strength train, do plyometrics, have some general strength. Okay, have some good base level of aerobic conditioning. If you don't have that, if you're just out of shape and fat, you're going to have to address that to be able to get faster. The good thing is that you can avoid all these mistakes if you train intelligently, you respect the principles that I've kind of talked about in this episode here today. Okay, yes, genetics will matter, but speed is trainable. Okay, genetics set your ceiling, but very few athletes are anywhere close to their genetic ceiling for speed because there's always room for improvement somewhere in all these things I've talked about. Okay, the question is whether you're willing to train smart enough, patient enough, and put in the effort, maybe find some help if you need to be able to maximize all those, to really maximize your actual speed development. So I'm going to bring this all together, tie with a pretty bow. This has been a longer episode, so I do apologize. I really started to kind of go into some of the science on some of this stuff and really wanted to make sure I cover everything here. But speed development is so much more than just running fast. Okay, you're not just endlessly doing sprints and hoping that you get faster. Understanding you're training multiple interrelated systems that all contribute to your ability to move quickly and efficiently. It's about training your nervous system to fire with precision and power, recruit high threshold motor units rapidly together to coordinate that complex movement pattern with split second timing, developing explosive strength and power to be able to produce massive amounts of force in the least amount of time that you possibly can, training across that force velocity curve that we talked about. You got to train all across that, ideally all year round to some degree. Mastering the biomechanics, efficiently dialing your technique, so that you're efficient while you're running and you're not wasting it on poor mechanics. You're getting in the right mental state. We talked about the mental piece of actually running hard and running fast. Understanding that there are specific ways you can train for your speed depending on your sport and what you need, whether that be linear acceleration, max velocity, change direction, reactive-based agility, or maybe even some combination of all those. And then also having intelligent programming, structuring your training so that you develop these qualities systematically over time with great periodization, enough recovery, and respect the actual adaptation of running fast. All these components are going to add up. You can't just work on one piece and ignore the others. You've got to be able to develop them all to be able to develop elite level speed. And the best athletes, they're strong and they're powerful. They have great technique. Their nervous system is highly trained and efficient. They're mentally prepared. They train the right types of speed for their sport, and they structure their training intelligently and maximize their recovery. So while this information without implementation would just be entertainment, and I appreciate you joining, I really do, I want you to be able to get better. I want to see you improve if you're looking for speed development here. And so I want to be able to help you push the boundaries of your speed development. So speed is not just given. It's not just genetic. Yes, there are people that are always going to be faster than you, and genetics do matter to an extent. But if you do this through intelligent training, consistency, attention to detail, love the process, respect the recovery, take some of the stuff away here today to be able to help you, I assure you, you will get faster and improve your speed. So I want to take you, I want to thank you, excuse me, for turning in to this episode of the First More Podcast. If you found value in this, and I really hope you did with how much time I invested in this episode, that you share it with a coach, share it with a friend, share it with an athlete, share with a training partner, someone that can benefit from this information. I appreciate it. You can leave a review on Apple iTunes, Spotify. If you're watching over on YouTube, give me a like, hit subscribe, leave a comment, let me enjoy the episode. And more importantly, if you got any questions, just let me know. I'd be happy to help you out. Until next time, I'll see you at the next episode. Keep training hard. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll see you at the next episode. Thanks for listening to Thirst for More Podcast. Make sure you give us a follow on Spotify, iTunes, or anywhere else you like to consume your podcast. You can also check us out on YouTube at The Smitley, where you'll find clips and lots of educational-based material for strength and conditioning and exercise science. You can also make sure you give me a follow on Instagram at bsmitley or at Team Thirst, which is my gym Instagram page. For any more future updates on episodes to come, you can make sure you follow me there. I'm your host, Brandon Smitley. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll catch you at the next episode.